Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, and Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Alfred Moore. Alfred is lecturer in political theory at the University of York. He has a new book, which is titled Critical Elitism, Deliberation, Democracy, and the Problem of Expertise. The book is published by Cambridge University Press. Now, according to a challenge that goes all the way back to Plato, democracy is unacceptable as a mode of political organization because it distributes political power equally among those who are unequal in wisdom. Plato goes on to object that democracies are suspicious of the very idea of expertise in political matters. He reasoned that political equality, that is the kind of political equality that's characteristic of a democracy, misleads citizens into thinking that each person is also equally wise. Long traditions in political philosophy have proposed various kinds of responses to Plato. And according to a predominant trend in contemporary political theory, public deliberation can serve as a way to meet some of Plato's challenges. Yet, appeals to public deliberation seem to reintroduce some of Plato's worries. For example, does the commitment to public deliberation suggest, with Plato, that wisdom in the end should rule? How can democracy introduce an ideal of deliberation that remains democratic? That's the general theme to which Alfred's book is devoted, and there's a lot to talk about. So why don't we begin where we usually do, by greeting the author. Hi, Alfred.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
I'm very well. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Philosophy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
No problem. Why don't we start off where we usually do again? Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, where to start? I was born in London, grew up in Leicester, which is a small industrial town in the middle of England. Nothing remarkable there. I suppose my academic career is a little bit meandering. I mean, I studied physics and philosophy as an undergraduate at King's College London. And between studying abroad and a master's program in politics, I did a PhD in political thought at the University of Bath. And then got a temporary job in Ireland. And then from there, I got a European Union fellowship. God love the European Union. To go to Vancouver for a few years to work on a project on epistemology and democracy. And it's that project from which this book ultimately came. And I suppose from after I left Vancouver, I came to work at Cambridge on a project on conspiracy and democracy. So it was another research fellowship. And that, I mean, more or less takes us up to the present.
Where you're now sitting in a brand new office, I'm told.
I'm sitting in a brand new office. I now have I'm now a lecturer in political theory at the University of York. I'm in my brand spanking new office. The walls are bare. My voice is probably echoing slightly from the lack of furniture in the room. But I have a computer and I have a glass of water. So I think that's probably pretty much all I need right now.
Well, that's fantastic. Why don't we then get started in talking about the book, Critical Elitism. Why don't we begin with some background? So critical elitism begins with or works within a general framework of thinking about democracy. And to give it a name, the book sort of comes out of the deliberative conception of democracy or within the framework of deliberative democracy. More specifically, you take up a particular version of deliberative democratic theory or a particular a plank within that general framework, which is sometimes called the systems approach to deliberation. Can you tell us a little bit about the background conception of democracy and particularly about the systems view of deliberation?
Yeah. I mean, so as you said, I mean, I'm working broadly within the framework of deliberative theories of democracy. And I suppose that that's a broad family of theories of democracy that place a premium on processes of communication and justification and mutual reason giving in the production of democratic legitimacy. And the I mean, for those who aren't familiar with the, you know, with the sort of, I suppose, with the narrower paradigm questions, which is where I'm stuck a little bit with the systems approach. I mean, the systems approach is a response within deliberative theory to a particular sort of to a particular trend. So what happened? So deliberative democratic theory has one of its, I think, one of its great strengths over the last 20 years has been the degree to which it has informed empirical research, and in particular, it's informed experimental political practice. And so throughout the 90s and 2000s, we saw increasing numbers of attempts to create spaces, to create institutional designs, to create small forums within which we could somehow make manifest some of the goods of deliberative democracy, some of the things that the theorists have placed a high value on, such as sincerity of communication, a kind of humility, a kind of equality, a kind of informed reasoned judgment. But have found that those sorts of qualities are precisely what's lacking in a mass mediatized, party-structured, money-dominated public sphere, and so have sought to create these kind of small institutional spaces. So the paradigm, so the sort of the research program, I should say, really, of deliberative democracy spent a lot of time focusing on both small empirical questions of political psychology and how small group deliberation works, what actually goes on, what sorts of power relations become implicit within spaces of democratic conversation, but also with this experimental approach of trying to create what they called mini publics. And so for an example that people might have heard of is James Fishkin's sort of deliberative polling.
Yeah, polling.
Deliberative polling. So these kinds of things, right? So deliberative democratic theory, so it started out with some quite abstract theoretical and normative concerns, particularly from figures like Jürgen Habermas in the European continental tradition, maybe people like Josh Cohen in the States, and then developed into this rich paradigm, which was exploring a lot of empirical questions, engaging with political science, and doing these institutional experiments. So what the systems view is doing within that disciplinary approach is trying to pull back the focus from the creation of small forums and the creation of pockets of deliberative quality, so to speak, within democratic systems, and trying to pull back the focus to, again, the question of how we might think about making a democratic system more deliberative, or how we might think about how to identify deliberative potentials within a larger political system. And so what this has led to, I think, is a re-emphasis on some of the early concerns about the public sphere, but probably with a more fine-grained appreciation for the different functions and different values of talking within different sorts of institutions. And so the deliberative systems view, you know, tries to move away from a conception of looking for one right forum, and rather starts to ask, well, what sorts of qualities do different sorts of forums have? What are the specific qualities of legislatures versus? What are the specific, you know, qualities of an open public debate and of particular sorts of institutional spaces? So it asks a set of old questions in a slightly new way, informed by the work that had gone on in between.
So, excellent. Can I ask one sort of follow-up on that? Does the systems approach also help deliberative theorists address some concerns, I think well-placed concerns, especially well-placed concerns that were voiced very early in the development of deliberative democratic theory, concerns about the demandingness of deliberation, that it seems like on some of the early versions of deliberative democracy, quite heavy burden was placed on democratic citizens to be doing a lot of talking and thinking and arguing and reason giving as individuals. Where is part of the motivation for the systems view to sort of focus on, sort of broader social institutional questions, questions about the way social systems work, to sort of distribute the burden away from individual citizens?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that is one of the motivations, that you can think in terms of a distribution of, of the sorts of things that deliberative Democrats wanted enhanced, wanted to enhance within democratic systems, to think of them as produced in different spaces and in different locations, in a way that didn't make this heavy sort of burden, this idea that everybody, this, as you say, it was, this quite unrealistic vision of democratic citizens behaving like they were in a philosophy seminar and taking on themselves a role of being sort of detached from their material interests and engaging in a certain style of debate. And so definitely the systems view takes on board that criticism, as indeed a lot of the empirical work in earlier work, strongly took on that idea and said, look, there's a space for angry, heated rhetoric, right? There's a space for enclaves of people with common interests who aren't talking to others but are clarifying their demands and locating themselves and trying to find a voice within a broader public debate. And that the systems view wants to sort of give appreciation to those different sorts of qualities and ask, well, how might then a democratic system come together? So it opens up, I suppose, a new set of problems, but it does attempt to deal with that that problem of burdening the democratic citizen.
Excellent. So that's great as some background to the analysis in the book. So we'll start with the encapsulation of the book on the back cover.
Good place to start.
Yeah, where the first sentence is, democracies have a problem with expertise. That I'm sure to our listeners, everyone will say, oh yeah, I think I know what that means. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about I take it there's more than one problem with expertise. Can you tell us a little bit about what kinds of problems or challenges the idea of expertise play, or what kinds of challenges are posed by the idea of expertise for democracy?
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems that I started with was this question, I suppose, of how to construct expert authority, sort of in a context, in a political context or a social context, in which habits of deference have, for various reasons, eroded, and people are increasingly empowered to challenge and contest expert claims. And I mean, climate change, I mean, I think we'll probably come back to this later. It's an example which I come back to in the book, and it's something that was certainly in mind as I set about this project. You know, seems to exemplify some of these trends. And I suppose the problem, I might frame it in terms of two contrasting intuitions. And one of them is that the capacity to criticize and contest expert claims seems to me in a democracy to be a very valuable thing, right? And precisely because expert claims implicitly stand outside democratic debate, they seem to be a sort of precondition on a lot of views for rational deliberation and not strictly a sort of a part of it. But it seems plain enough, and it's certainly been a focus of many critical thinkers, sociologists of science, among many others, that the question of, say, how problems are framed, whose voice counts within within the development of expertise, what sorts of values or judgments or assumptions or choices might be embedded within expert claims, that it seems extremely valuable to have procedures of public contestation through which those kind might be sort of exposed and adapted. So, I mean, to put it bluntly, the intuition seems like criticism is a valuable thing in this context, precisely because expertise can be a mask for power. But on the other hand, I have this sense that there is a great value to authoritative expertise within political systems generally, but within democratic systems for sure, in which we need to have, in complex societies, we need expert voices to inform political debate and public debate. Public deliberation needs to be informed accurately about technical potentials of particular things. They need to be, this is a sort of, I suppose, a very old sort of Deweyan point, but in order to credibly kind of act on the kinds of things that we might want in the world, we need to be well informed about facts of the case, but well informed about technical potentials and the sorts of expert judgments that we're going to rely on. So yeah, we need experts to help us inform political and public deliberation. We need experts to empower collective action. So when we take up policies, when we make a decision about something, it doesn't just automatically fall out. It involves a lot of complex further judgments, and those judgments are sort of substantively rich. They often involve a lot of discretion, and there's an important role for experts in getting things done in democratic life. And I mean, and this isn't an exhaustive list of things that are useful about expertise, but they're also valuable for sort of telling truth to power, so to speak, right? Of having a somewhat autonomous basis from which to push back against political claims. And so, as the sociologist Michael Shudson puts it, we don't want our experts to be toadies, just telling politicians or telling the people, in fact, what they want to hear. So I have these sort of two intuitions sort of pushing against one another that are saying, yes, there's something valuable about having contestation and criticism, and there's something valuable about expert authority. And the question I sort of ended up framing this as was, how do we have inclusion without collapsing the very concept of expertise? So how do we engage public judgment in expert practices in a way that doesn't just reduce to a kind of populism?
Right. Excellent. So yeah, it's a problem with a long pedigree. Right. Going back to Plato. So let me just make sure I've got it. So the sort of two prongs, the competing intuitions are as follows. On the one hand, it seems like it's essential to democracy that nobody has to defer his or her judgment, that democracy involves exercises of judgment, and that includes processes of challenge and objection and contestation. So it looks like we need a lot of that. On the other hand, the complex problems to which democracies have to address look like they can be addressed intelligently, to use a Deweyan word, only if there is some degree of acknowledged expertise. Only if we can, let me put it this way, to further Deweyanize the thought, only if we could make good use of the division of epistemic labor. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. So then I guess one way to, and the way that you cash out the issue, or the way that you characterize the conflict between these two intuitions, is that we need a distinction then between epistemic authority and political authority. Is that right?
Yeah. Or I suppose, as I put it, is more that we need a democratic account of expert authority, in a sense. I mean, one of the things that I try to do is try to think about expert authority not as something that stands outside politics and that simply must be taken up in deliberation or taken up somewhat blindly, that we're sort of in a position of having to rely on experts in this sense before we can then go on to form our own judgments and so on. But one in which there's a sense in which the judgment of ordinary citizens is involved in the production of expert authority.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about how that works?
So one of the big, I suppose, I do start with that distinction between sort of epistemic and political authority. And one of the ways in which you might commonly distinguish between political and epistemic authority is in terms of the role of a kind of surrender of judgment.
Right.
And we might think that, we commonly think that the concept of authority, the concept of political authority, but also the concept of epistemic authority, involves some moment of surrendering one's judgment and replacing it with the judgment of another. Right? It involves this notion of surrendering. But in political relations, we can also quite clearly sort of distinguish between submitting in our conduct, but not in our private judgment. So we can say, I'm choosing to, you know, so we can say, I'm choosing to go along with political authority, but I'm not giving up my independent judgment of the terms of that relationship, so to speak. So there always remains this sort of tension between sort of trust and judgment within relations of authority. And I suppose the puzzle that I was thinking, at least at this level of thinking about concepts of expert authority, was that this sort of separation seems not to apply so easily to expert authority. Because the idea that we could separate our sort of public conformity on the one hand to our private judgments on the other sort of doesn't seem to work when we're being asked to defer, you know, to in essence say, believe a claim because some authority has made it. And so it's this, you know, and I mean, Nancy Rosenblum, I use as an example of someone who sort of sets up this problem. So Nancy Rosenblum sort of mentions, you know, she says that the liberal dynamic of trust, distrust, and judgment is irrelevant to epistemic authority. Deference to the superior knowledge of experts is just that, and it stems from a sense of inferiority and faith. And so what I wanted to do was then sort of push back against that sort of intuition a bit, you know, and get to a sense in which we can still have expert authority, but we can have it in a way that engages our judgment off the terms of the relationship itself. And it's in this context that I draw on, I just found it useful to draw on Jonathan Cohen's distinction between belief and acceptance as a way of framing this more critical relationship that we might have between, you know, because he distinguishes between belief in the sense of, say, reporting or introspecting some feeling that you just happen to have about the world, right, about the truth of something, and acceptance as a reflective, conscious judgment to take up a claim as what he calls a sort of a policy for reasoning, as a decision to make something present in your judgment. And so I found that a useful way of framing this possibility of being within a relation of epistemic authority and yet not letting go of one's capacity to sort of judge the terms of that relationship.
So is the thought then that in when it comes to the epistemic authority, the report of the epistemic authority is such that one could defer to that authority and in some sense adopt the report from the authority without sort of fully surrendering one's judgment.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thought. I mean, that's the idea. That's the thought I wanted to at least develop and try to, you know, and try to work with here. And this idea that, you know, you could agree to treat something as a fact for the purposes of a policy deliberation while continuing perhaps to not believe it or to privately doubt it, and to have, you know, and to contain those doubts while one is still in this relationship, so that we can be within a relationship where we accept authoritative claims and yet still worry about them. And so, I mean, I suppose that's something that I try to push through later in the book, where I talk about sort of institutions and practices of contestation, because it's sort of, I argue, I suppose, that part of the value of contestation is that it encourages a reflective relationship, right? It encourages the possibility of reflective acceptance instead of, say, just blind belief or disbelief, or just happening to believe or disbelieve claims.
Right. So good. So why don't we, maybe then I'll ask you to, at this point, sort of pull, you know, to fill in more of the detail of the positive view. So your view, which sort of has as its central plank this kind of distinction where it's possible to give epistemic authorities their due without surrendering or without in problematic ways deferring. That is, that there's a space where you can give the authorities their due, but still exercise your judgment. You call this view critical elitism. Can you spell out some of the details about the broader picture?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was unsure about using the term critical elitism, but I ended up going with it in the end because I wanted to capture a sense in which I wanted to characterize something that is a relationship of inequality, and so that is a sort of essentially a kind of hierarchical relationship, but to emphasize the way in which I imagine, I propose that critical judgment is essential to the production of that relationship, so to the production of expert authority. And I think that general sort of view, as we've just talked a little bit about it in the more conceptual terms, but I think that general view has sort of democratic or has institutional implications, because if we say that this practice of authority, you know, requires not docile agents, citizens who believe what experts tell them, but it requires autonomous agents capable of a kind of judgment in this context, then it also demands that we think about the institutional conditions that enable those kinds of reflective judgments. That is, that we enable institutions that don't presuppose the relation between experts and citizens is one in which experts privately do their business and produce claims, and then citizens just believe them if they're good citizens, but rather institutions that set up avenues and possibilities for a kind of critical scrutiny and contestation that can at least give the potential for pushing back, testing, and in effect testing it. Expert claims to authority by making demands for justification. And so this, to me at least, what I wanted to do with this critical elitism was link together these quite sort of abstract thoughts about the nature of epistemic authority, but link them to institutional problems and possibilities. So to me, these two were quite closely linked. By recognizing a potential role for judgment within the production of expert authority, it also pushes us to ask about the kinds of institutions that might support that judgment, or how that sort of process can go wrong. The way, you know, what sorts of, so how that took me at least towards a set of institutional design questions, I suppose.
Right. So why don't we pick up there? So one of the, maybe we'll call it a case study, we might say, in the book, has to do with ClimateGate and a way in which the idea of contesting expert claims can go wrong, or one of the hazards that this invites. Can you tell us a little bit about that discussion in the book?
Yeah. So, I mean, as I said at the beginning, I mean, one of the problems that sort of animated this in a way was the question of climate change, and particularly the way in which knowledge about climate change was supposed to function in public debate. And it seemed to me sort of somehow a little bit problematic, but one of the really interesting things about the climate change debate, from my point of view, is the creation of this weird and very novel kind of international institution, you know, at the level of a UN panel that is essentially a collection of very large group of experts drawing together, doing essentially extremely large literature reviews and trying to put together a package of knowledge that would be labeled the scientific consensus, you know, that would be the scientific consensus on climate change, and then present that to audiences of policymakers and publics around the world. And to me, this in its inspiration seems to fit the not so democratic model of expert authority, in which experts do their business and then create a package of of claims that is then supposed to be simply taken up in the public debate. But the IPCC itself has been, itself has an interesting history and has an interesting history in its relation to various attacks and criticisms that have been made of the process and of the very idea of knowledge about climate change. So the Climategate debate was this, it was occasioned by a leak or a hacking of a number of emails from a small climate change research unit at the University of East Anglia in England in 2009. And this was sort of on the eve of Copenhagen Climate Summit. And so this was a politically, you know, this was a politically charged time in the debates about climate change. But these emails were hacked, released, and essentially a lot of backstage talk among the scientists was made public. And a lot of that backstage talk concerned getting around requests from freedom of information requests from antagonistic critics who they thought, the climate scientists, who the climate scientists thought wanted to take their take pieces of information out of context and use in campaigns to attack them, but which to climate critics seemed to expose the process of forming a scientific consensus. Essentially, what it seemed to do was say, look, there's this idea of the scientific consensus is sold to us as though it's the independent convergence of numerous different experts about the state of the world. And therefore, we should believe it. What these emails seemed to reveal to the critics was that behind this consensus was a group of perhaps politically, perhaps ideologically, perhaps just professionally motivated people gaming the process. And it seemed to them to be a scandal which undercut the very idea of an expert consensus around climate change. And so what I really do in the chapter where I discuss this sort of difficult, puzzling case is say that is really express, I suppose, a bit of sympathy for the IPCC, but also suggest that there is something problematic about this. There's a tension within this way of generating expert authority that it ends up falling prey to this implicit expectation that the consensus means there was no longer any significant disagreement, but by not articulating the disagreements and by not articulating the uncertainties in an open sort of way, it makes it vulnerable and a bit fragile to this sort of attack. And as I said, I'm sympathetic to the institution because it has developed over time to be a much more reflective, transparent, and sort of open institution in its practice. So, you know, if you do want to sort of challenge their claims or look at how their claims were constructed, you know, you really can in a quite remarkably open sort of way. But there's still this implicit, I think they end up struggling against this implicit conception of expert authority that's there in the very idea of, you know, putting together a giant international panel and developing something that's supposed to just stand as a sort of, you know, as a sort of unit of expert claim in subsequent public debates.
Right, right. So it looks as if there, the tension that you're pointing to is really interesting because, you know, it's not uncommon to hear people, at least in the States, I should say, maybe this is unique to the States, express the thought that, geeky professors aren't going to dictate to me what to think about anything. Right? Yeah. There's this idea that that there's something conspiratorial about when people talk about the scientific consensus on climate change and the climate change deniers sort of think that there's a that where there's consensus, there's got to be some kind of something conspiratorial or something forced and not rational about the consensus. And so I wonder, to what extent then does the idea that expert authority is in a democratic system has to be authorized in a way through popular processes of criticism and challenge and contestation. To what extent does that require of democratic citizens, the people doing the contesting and the challenging, a level of scientific competence? So let me just give one other example, maybe unique to the States. I suspect it is, unfortunately. I suspect that this happens in the States and it's unfortunate. In the States, we still hear people say things like evolution's just a theory. And it seems as if in that, people who are creationists of some kind or intelligent design people of some kind sort of say it's just a theory. Clearly they're being misled or they're employing a concept of theory that doesn't jibe well. I mean, with, how science works, right? Like, everything's just a theory. In a certain sense, some theories are better confirmed than others. And so, That it's just a theory is what makes it scientific, not what makes it something that we're not that there's no requirement on our rationality to adopt, right?
This brings back that sort of essential problem, this essential problem that we have at the beginning, where if we might want some. We might want our sort of expert claims to be open to the possibilities of criticism and scrutiny in various ways, and yet it seems that the sort of public scrutiny is going to be uninformed in such a way that makes it very counterproductive. And I think this sort of problem does get to our genuine sort of democratic problem in a sense, because what it does is it puts the sort of arrow of authorization for inclusion, so to speak, like with the experts. It says we will decide who is qualified to, we will set up the appropriate qualifications for criticism and in a way it's at the end of that road, it seems almost like people have to be qualified, but people have to pass a certain sort of standard in order to contest. And that seems to, again, butt up against the sort of the democratic intuition, which is like, you don't tell me what to do. So, that really sort of, it recasts the essential problem that I suppose that I'm grappling with. When I think of examples like, say, this climate change denial and examples like vaccine critics and so on. This is another one where, we have a genuine problem here. And it's a problem in that it's not just about why it's nice to believe true things about the world. It's about life and death. I mean, it makes a difference for policy. And these are one of those cases where experts are advising on what people should do in a way that makes a material difference, and in a way that where the stakes are pretty high.
I did an episode of New Books in Philosophy a couple of months ago with an author who named Mike Navin, who did a book about the anti-vax community.
Sounds like a book I should have read.
it was a very interesting book. You can go listen to the interview.
I will.
One of the things that was very, very interesting about that particular community is that the average anti-vaxxer knows more about the vaccines than your average citizen. So they exercise a certain level of epistemic virtue that somehow, in a way that this author, Mark Navin, theorizes, you know, they have certain epistemic virtues that then get subverted by a certain kind of tendency towards conspiratorial accounts of their critics, right? I mean, that seems to be the something goes wrong somewhere, but it's not in the information gathering, or it's not they know stuff about how vaccines work, and so it's a and maybe that is different from the climate change denial group.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, From what I know of some of the opinion and survey research, I mean, there's a lot of political science stuff and political psychology on this in the climate change area. There's a similar sort of pattern in that the critics are, on certain measures, better informed about the substantive issues than people like, say, me, who don't delve into the weeds of the various reports and debates. But who just sort of, you know, that I do exercise a kind of trust in those, you know, in those expert judgments. And I suppose one of the things that I take from the kind of deliberative systems approach is this idea that, okay, can we think about a way in which that sort of critical practice, even when it's misguided, right, even when it seems to be getting things wrong, can serve a useful function, right? Can serve a useful purpose in a broader public debate. And on this question, in an empirical sense, I'm torn, because I think on the one hand, part of the reason that I trust the sorts of claims about climate change is precisely because they have been forged in the context of such skilled and hostile scrutiny. Right. It's partly that context of contestation that gives me some grounds to think that this is actually, you know, this is actually a pretty robust sort of set of claims. And so in a sense, I end up kind of sketching an idea, you know, of a way in which certain groups of one-eyed, you know, perhaps one-eyed, perhaps misguided critics can be sort of substantively wrong, or grab the wrong end of the stick, or be conspiratorial or something, and yet still make challenges to expert institutions who make claims to authority, make challenges to them to justify and give an account of themselves. And it's that account is not going to persuade them, but it might persuade me.
Right.
You know, and so that account of what they're doing, that account of their procedures, that account of the sorts of judgments that they've made. So in a way, and I'm the reason I'm wary is that I'm aware that this sort of thing, I you know, by saying, well, these wild and unruly, implacable, obstinate, conspiratorial, perhaps even, you know, malignly motivated or, you know, financially motivated critics can somehow be turned, like by some invisible hand, into a way of strengthening expert, a resource for strengthening expert authority. I mean, I'm sort of torn, because clearly that can go wrong too, right? The contestatory environment can be gamed, and it can, you know, but I wanted to develop that as one sort of potential in which we could say, look, it doesn't have to be the case that everybody is, you know, that these critics are right, or that even that they have a particularly good point. What matters is that the institution responds in a way that can give confidence to an audience who isn't quite so obsessive about things.
So good. Let me then that prompts a question. So I'm wondering now, what about what your view entails from the with respect to social duties or social responsibilities or obligations of scientific inquirers to subject themselves or to make themselves available to this kind of scrutiny. And I'm thinking of one particular case. So about 10 years ago, Richard Dawkins wrote a short piece called "Why I Don't Debate Creationists," and his stance in that essay was that he's no longer going to debate creationists, because he came to realize that from the creationist strategy, the point of having a creationist debate, Richard Dawkins, has nothing to do with the actual exchange of ideas. Mm. It simply has to do with a PR campaign so that the creationists among their among the community of sympathizers can point to, creationist scientists and say, that person shared the stage with Richard Dawkins. And the actual outcome of the exchange, Dawkins claims, the outcome of the exchange wasn't the point. The point was just to have the, just to be able to say, one of our guys went up against Richard Dawkins and held his own against Richard Dawkins. And he said, so the argument is I'm not debating these people anymore because for them it's a PR strategy, not about the science.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that's not an additional kind of worry that if the critical elitism view requires that scientists engage publicly in ways that have them exposed to these processes of popular critical authorization of their expertise. That sounds like good stuff, right? That sounds like a good idea to me. But then it looks like that can be manipulated or capitalized. It could be gamed, right? Good.
I agree with you. I mean, because I think that is a serious. I mean, that's a difficult sort of judgment that. Scientists have to make. I mean, when you were saying that, I was thinking of a different example, but that I was recently at a talk with Deborah Lipstadt, who was in a similar situation with respect to Holocaust deniers, and who simply wanted the implicit status that came with being on a platform in a way that appeared as though they were two rival, equally credible views on this. And I think the way in which one of the ways in which we can respond to this is to think in more differentiated institutional terms about the kinds of platforms or the kinds of ways we might engage. Like on one sort of platform is this debating the rival experts or the rival claims. But I mean, I give an example in the book of a different way of engaging with critics that involved in this case, in the case of the Dutch Environment Agency, actually inviting climate skeptics into their building. And it involved proactively inviting a sort of crowdsourced scrutiny of some of their documents with a typology of errors that they might find, right? So they in effect take the initiative of saying, we'll frame what look like appropriate sorts of errors. And so in that sense, you might, that expert institutions, experts do have, I think, this sort of duty, but they can be proactive about it in ways that can resist this sort of gaming. Because I think you're right. I mean, this is something that's become more apparent, certainly over the last few years. And since I wrote the book, it's become very politically apparent that engaging in what looks like a substantive debate can actually be a strategy of distraction or a strategy of promotion or to doing something quite different. And I think clearly as a matter of sort of practical judgment, experts do need to be aware of that context. But it points to a temptation of withdrawal. And I think in the example of the climate gate debate, one of the things that you see in the emails is precisely a sense on the part of experts of not wanting to give fuel to the critics, of not wanting to engage, and of wanting to, with good reason, I think, suspecting that freedom of information requests were part of a gaming, right? That they were part of a political struggle in which they were being played. And yet, by trying to withdraw in a certain kind of way, they ended up inviting more suspicion, right? By trying to evade freedom of information. So, I mean, I think it just puts where we're dealing with where we're dealing with political issues that engage serious material and ideological oppositions, it's unavoidably and unfortunately does put experts in the position of having to make what are essentially political judgments and judgments about how their words carry weight and about how their and how the way the strategies of engagement that they deploy, how they work and how they, you know, and how they can backfire. So, but I think that's a genuine problem.
Yeah. And I guess that one dimension of the problem in this sort of the way in which this idea of sort of critical legitimation of epistemic authority, the way in which it can be gamed, it's sort of, the scientific community actually is put in a position where, you know, the critics aren't really playing the same game that they are, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That the critics are really after something else, right? They're after, and so it's not even clear whether the scientific community has any of the skills, right, that would enable them to navigate this well. I mean, it seems like the problem runs deep, I guess.
And it raises the unfortunate, specter of a group of climate scientists hiring Karl Rove to do their PR. You know, if we want to fight back in a credible way, I'm not sure that would be a great idea. But I think it is a genuine problem, and possibly one that I underestimated or haven't, you know, in the book. And I suppose in a way, I probably assumed a little, not a lot more, but a little more good faith in some of the critical positioning and some of the examples. I mean, if I think of the example of, say, vaccine critics, or think of an example with a sort of different valence, but the way that AIDS activists engaged with scientific expertise around those cases, you know, these were ones in which there were marginal groups with genuine grievances and a sense that they were that their interests were not being taken into account in a proper way in decisions that were taking place at a technical level, right? And that they sought that sort of engagement. But I mean, where we are dealing, you know, and there's particularly now, I think, a growing literature on sort of agnotology or the study of the production of uncertainty, right, in which you do see an explicit political gaming of scientific processes of scientific procedures, and in a way that they're particularly vulnerable to, precisely because they don't have the kind of this political or institutional sort of way of thinking about what they're doing.
Right, and I guess that in the sort of production of doubt stuff, I mean, this is a lot of stuff about the climate change denial is about this, where, you know, one of the problems is that the way the public is encouraged to think or adopt the view that there is significant doubt or uncertainty about climate change, whether it's happening, if it is happening, what its sources are. You know, often those narratives appeal to what in other contexts are just obvious epistemic virtues. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's sort of parasitic on a pretty attractive conception of what good, critical, sincere, scrutinizing, autonomous citizens should be doing.
and it somehow
subverts it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I mean, it is. That's it gets a lot of its charge precisely from that sort of claim, you know, and that the climate denialists, they don't call themselves denialists. Of course,
exactly,
they call themselves skeptics.
That's exactly.
And precisely the struggle to define them as denialists with some sort of clearly psychological problem is the implication of denial, rather than skeptics, which carries all of the good baggage from Galileo to today. Through, you know, so. This sort of subversion of what seem like epistemic virtues of citizens is genuinely problematic.
Well, Alfred, you've been very generous with your time, and the last six or eight minutes of our conversation just suggest to our listeners that that the critical elitism book that you've just written really opens up, not only lays the framework for thinking about, but really opens up a broad range of questions. So maybe it's appropriate to ask my usual, final question. What will you work on next?
Great question. I mean, I'm working on a few different things that come next. I mean, one of them sort of follows directly from this, right? And follows directly from the shape of our conversation, which is, as I mentioned, the last couple of years I've been working on a research project at Cambridge called Conspiracy and Democracy. It's been quite a broad-ranging research project, but in which I've had a particular interest in questions of, the sort of questions we've just been talking about now, right? And also more general, as in beyond the question of expertise, questions of the relationship between trust and distrust in democratic systems. So I'm particularly interested in developing this idea of working more on the ideas of trust and distrust. One of the things that I noticed when we've been doing some of this research around people who are writing and thinking about conspiracy and conspiracism is that a lot of the work is in political psychology. And among the many examples, one of the prominent examples that's used is climate change denial. It's used as a proxy. And indeed, in one of the papers, a guy called Stefan Lewandowski, who's a quite prominent political psychologist, who has written about climate change denial and has studied climate denialists. He even makes a comment in relation to scientific consensus where he says he thinks that, in passing and at the beginning of one of his papers about how, the prominence of conspiracist ideation in this context is no surprise when we think that if people see what looks like a consensus and then they find out that behind the scenes, that's actually people disagreed, in fact, and then somehow there was some decision to make this the consensus, they'll think that that was a conspiracy. And so one of the strands of work sort of follows directly from that in thinking more about the relationship of trust and distrust. Another thing I've actually been working on lately that doesn't directly have anything to do with the book, which in many ways has been a great relief and a fun thing to do, but has been thinking about the network public sphere. And I suppose it relates in a way in that one of the things when people sort of, when people like me do a kind of hand-wavy sociology of the present, sociology of the last 5 minutes, as one of my colleagues calls it, and says, look, part of the problem of this decline of authority is the rise of the internet. It's the leveling of a capacity for voice. It makes transaction costs lower. It enables people to find like-minded others more quickly. Cass Sunstein writes about all this stuff. Sure. So I think the question of what difference the network, what difference the internet is making to our political public sphere is a genuinely important sort of problem in the world. One of the projects I've been working on lately has been a project looking at online political discourse and looking at particularly the role of anonymity and identifiability within our online public political talk. And that's involved me teaming up with a data scientist and doing a lot of, web scraping of data, online comments, from the Huffington Post from a few years ago, in which, where they changed their commenting regulations from anonymous through to a different sort of hybrid regime to using Facebook as a sort of real name identifier. And then looking at the changes in behavior. So that's been in a way, a quite different project, but one that I've found fascinating and that has spurred me to be writing quite recently about anonymity and deliberation, which I don't think is at least within the narrow world of deliberative democratic theory. I think that relationship hasn't really been very well explored, but it's something that becomes very much more prominent with the sort of possibilities that the internet creates.
That's right. A quick question about a related thing. So. I understand that in Denmark there is an online news outlet that has adopted the policy of before you can comment on a news story, you have to correctly answer questions about its content.
So I was
going to ask you if you know anything about is anybody that sounds to me like a fascinating thing for someone to study.
I've heard about it, and I've heard in a way it speaks to this one of the interesting things methodologically about the development of the internet is that it creates enormous possibilities for experimentation and for, in a sense, I suppose, online institutional design, of thinking up sorts of devices and ways of structuring forums for conversation that could push them more towards the sort of thing that we might want from them.
Right.
You know, I think I might follow up the Danish example. I mean, it's an interesting case.
Well, Alfred, the two of us can keep talking. I want to just thank you for your time and for talking to us about your wonderful book. Thank you, listeners, for joining us for the discussion of Alfred Moore's book. It's titled Critical Elitism, Deliberation, Democracy, and the Problem of Expertise. It's published with Cambridge University Press. Thanks for tuning in to New Books in Philosophy, and have a good day. Bye for now.